It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. We're reporting on last night's stunning victory by Democrat Doug Jones in Alabama's U.S. Senate election. First Democratic Senate victory in quarter century in Alabama, one of the reddest of red states. And with us, we have the chair of the Washington State Republican Party. Welcome back, Susan Hutchison.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be with you.
Why did Roy Moore lose?
Well, because he wasn't a very good candidate. And you said it right. It's the reddest of red states. I often, when I talk about the difference in my role as a member of the RNC and all the various states and whether they're purple or blue or red, I often use Alabama as an example. And the problem when you have an all-red state or an all-blue state is that the party turns on itself sometimes. And so while we saw that last year with the Democrats here, and, you know, they—
Which election?
The 2016, mm-hmm. where— they represented two different factions. They fired their chairman. There was all kinds of consternation and arguing going on. And we were just, you know, peace and goodwill on our side because we clearly see what the fight is. But when you feel like you own everything, like the Republicans do in Alabama, there's just a tendency to break into factions and fight one another. And I think that that's what happened in the primary, which resulted in Roy Moore.
Instead of Luther Strange.
Right.
You're on the executive committee of the Republican National Committee that endorsed Roy Moore. Did you support that decision?
I was not in support of that decision. I chose to remain neutral in this because, you know, it's Alabama, and my focus, as I always say, my job is to elect good Republicans, to work with good Democrats, to do good for the people of Washington State. And knowing that there was really the setup on this entire election with the revelations about his personal life put the Republicans in a position of you were damned if you did and damned if you didn't.
Did you believe the allegations against Roy Moore?
You know, I didn't follow it really closely.
On the Republican National Committee, that wasn't a big focus.
Well, there's lots of allegations to follow these
yes,
days.
Indeed.
So, you know, I read it. I just don't make it to the 56th paragraph in the article.
Well, the sexual assault allegations, did you find those credible?
I definitely find women who complain, especially in numbers, credible. Absolutely. What I don't find credible is that he's run for election 8 times and none of this ever came out. But I do think that it's possible that the women were emboldened to speak up because of the Weinstein and the successive issues where women realized that the risk of speaking up would not harm them. And so
would you have voted for Roy Moore yourself?
I don't know. You know, I think that one of the problems that we have when we're analyzing elections is saying things like we're looking at his past and so we don't like him. So, you know, we can't support him. I totally get that. But there are only 2 people running. And so in a way, there are a lot of people who just said, you know what? I can't look at the past. I'm going to look at the future. And the future is not good. For my issues, this is what an Alabamian might say, with a Democrat in this role. But, you know, you saw what happened with Senator Shelby a day before the election.
This is Alabama's senior senator came out and said, I wouldn't vote for him.
Yeah. And he's so well respected.
Yes.
Senator Shelby is. He said he didn't vote for him, that he wrote in another name.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he was saying, I'm willing to give up the future and having a Republican senator.
Well, what would you do? Because you're right. The Democrats and Republicans both are having to make choices like this, revelations,
yeah.
allegations. Would you vote for a candidate with those allegations against him? You're saying you found them generally possible,
yeah.
at least credible.
I wanted Roy Moore to drop out of the race. That's
yeah.
what I wanted him to do. And quite frankly, I think this is good for the Republican Party going forward. It is a blow to the Senate numbers, for sure. It's not a fatal blow. But at the same time, it's a one-off. And it is a Republican state. And, you know, 23,000 people wrote in someone else's name, which is really unusual. And Roy Moore lost by 20,000 votes. So, you know, you can just do the math. And you know that if it had been a credible candidate like Luther Strange, he would have won in a landslide, because that's what happens in Alabama.
Well, as for whether this is a one-off or what this says, bigger picture about the Republican Party, I'm sure you'll be very interested in this. The Democratic Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, has an opinion, has some advice for your party.
It would be a big mistake for Republicans to dismiss his loss only as a result of Moore's personal past. The Republican brand, even in deep red Alabama, is positively toxic.
So you're calling it a one-off, but would you agree that the Republican brand is toxic?
No, not at all. I don't believe that at all. In fact, let me just give you some stats. Jones, the Democrat, finished at 93% of Hillary's 2016 vote in numbers. And Roy Moore came in at 50% of Trump's 2016 numbers. So he couldn't even get the Trump supporters to support him. And I think that's very indicative of the situation there in Alabama. People were really torn. They wanted to vote Republican because that's what they stand for. Those are the issues they care about. But they couldn't do it. And so that is what this election means. And
does the GOP have an image problem? I mean, Alabama Republicans rejected him despite the endorsement of the Republican president of the United States.
Well, let's go back. It might be instructive to do that. Let's go back to the primary and how the Alabamians ended up with Roy Moore. During that primary this summer, the people were furious with Congress. They were furious that they would set us up to revoke Obamacare, and then they couldn't get it passed. People felt that the Congress wasn't supportive of the president. The reason I know this is because we get letters all the time, and all through those summer months, we were getting letters that said, I'm not going to give another cent to you here at the Washington State Republican Party until the Congress supports our president. So that was happening in Alabama. And Luther Strange caught himself in the strange position of being somewhat of an incumbent since he had been appointed. And so it was one of those, we're going to throw the bums out, anger votes. And as you know, in politics, so much of politics is timing and luck. And so, you know, we often say that somebody is peaking, and if there had just been two more weeks until the election, that person would have won. But there weren't two more weeks. And, you know, this primary hit when the voters were angry and they said, okay, we're going to vote for the iconoclast.
Let's take an election upcoming in Washington State. Would you welcome President Trump's endorsement of the Republican in the 8th, the district where Dave Reichert is leaving?
There's no doubt that the president is going to endorse if he plans to endorse at all on the West Coast, that he would endorse Dino Rossi. Dino is
a would that
fantastic.
Help Rossi? Would you welcome that?
Well, I think it would certainly not hurt him because he needs the Republican votes. It's a conservative district. The Democrats love to say that it's up for grabs. It's not. It's a conservative district. But Dino Rossi is such a far cry from Roy Moore that it's not even comparable. Roy Moore was an extraordinarily flawed candidate. And as you know, a lot of people believed he was going to be an albatross around the neck of future candidates. And now the Republicans don't have to deal with it. So perhaps Senator Shelby, in his wisdom, decided that we didn't need that going forward, that we would sacrifice this election so that we didn't have someone with this kind of arrogance and reputation hanging around our necks as we move forward.
Okay, so you don't think, by the way, we're talking with Washington State's Republican Party Chair, Susan Hutchison, you don't think that a President Trump endorsement of Dino Rossi would hurt Rossi here in the 8th District. What about, I want to talk about another figure that looms large nationally in the GOP. This is Republican Congressmember Peter King saying that after the Alabama disaster, the GOP must dump Steve Bannon.
He does not represent anything that I stand for. I consider myself a conservative Republican. I consider myself an Irish Catholic. And he sort of parades himself out there with his weird alt-right views that he has. And to me, it's demeaning the whole governmental and political process.
Does the Republican Party need to back away? You're on the RNC Executive Committee. Do you tell Steve Bannon, back off, go away?
Well, you know, I've never met Steve at all. He's never been around us at the RNC. Again, he's one of those sort of characters on the border or the outer borders of the party. And so he sort of set himself up for this. When you claim credit for getting somebody into or past a primary, then you've got to deal with the consequences. So he's a smart man. He certainly had an impact on President Trump's election, as did the RNC, as I love to say. You know, we did the ground game, and that's why he won in Florida and a number of other states, the hard work of the RNC. But, you know, when it comes to Steve Bannon, I don't know what's going to happen to him. He's not a friend of mine. I've never met him. I don't know him, but he's got to bear the burden of this.
Shifting to another topic, a lot of men, politicians included, have quit after sexual misconduct allegations. Washington State has a Republican, Matt Manweller, who's accused, but who says we're in a Weinstein witch hunt. What do you think?
Well, I've worked with Matt on a few things over the years. He's a really smart guy. He's a PhD, and he's been an asset in the legislature. But no one should have to be exposed to sexual harassment in the workplace or sexual assault of any kind.
He says there's nothing to the allegations. Maybe it was a compliment taken wrong. Are you saying you find the accusations more credible than that?
You know, I think the credibility of Central Washington University is on the line, and they're going to have to do that investigation for sure.
How about in the state legislature? Some lobbyists had criticized personal comments from him, though Seattle Times quoted a couple lobbyists who say women in Olympia prepare newcomers by warning them about spending time alone with not just Matt Manweller, but other legislators, Republican and Democrat.
Right. I don't think this is one party or the other. In fact, there's a question now about Pat Sullivan, because one of the fellows who quietly resigned on a Democrat from the legislature a few years ago was protected by Pat Sullivan, who's the leader in the House. In other words, he's one step below the speaker. He's a Democrat. So he helped him quietly leave. And I understand this former representative is now working in a school or a college, and he's around young people. So, you know, Pat Sullivan's probably got some answering to do on that.
Is there anyone you're ready to call on in Olympia to step down?
I'm not aware of anything on our side. I have heard about the allegations about Matt Manweller, and I hope that the investigation is swift so it can be that can be taken care of.
We've been talking about the Alabama election, Alabamians sending a Democrat to the U.S. Senate, and also just the brand and the prospects of the Republican Party, bigger picture. And we've been talking about it with the chair of the state Republican Party, Susan Hutchison. Always good to see you. We come back again.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be with you.
Thanks for coming in. It's The Record on KUOW. Back in a moment. So we were just talking there with the chair of the state Republican Party, Susan Hutchison. Let's go now to NPR politics editor Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thank you. What's your take on the Roy Moore defeat that we've been discussing?
Well, just in case my boss is listening, I should say I cover Congress. I'm not an editor. I think Republicans like Susan have a lot of questions they need to answer for themselves today, because you have a Democrat representing the state of Alabama in the United States Senate in a couple weeks. I mean, it's an extraordinary result, and 19 things had to go right, I think, for a Democrat to win, and they all seemed to fall into place. You had a candidate who was incredibly flawed, Roy Moore, but he didn't end up on the top of the ticket as an accident. You had President Trump campaigning for him over the final weeks, and you had high-profile Republicans like Steve Bannon out on the campaign trail for Roy Moore during the primary with Luther Strange, advocating for him, campaigning for him, getting him to a place where he could win that primary.
What are you hearing from other Republicans about the state and the future of their party?
Honestly, I think that on some level, many Republicans in the Senate today are relieved that Roy Moore did not win this election. They do not love the fact that it's a narrow margin now, 51-49. I mean, think back to all of these votes that happened over the course of the last year, the Obamacare repeal attempt that failed, the tax overhaul that just barely passed in the Senate the first time around. There's some question as to whether they can get the votes the next time around next week. Looks like they will, but it'll still be close. That was with a 52-48 margin. 51-49 is that much closer. If two Republicans decide they want to hold out on any issue, they can't get it done in the Senate. So that's going to be tough. But that being said, I think that's a more manageable headache than whatever Roy Moore would say next every single day coming through the Senate, going through the crowd of reporters who are always standing there waiting to talk to him. And also the open question of what to do with someone with these allegations against him.
Yes, Washington's Susan Hutchinson said she's one of those Republican leaders who believes that, who feels relieved, better off not to have Roy Moore representing the party in the Senate. How much do you think this says about Republican support for President Trump, who endorsed Moore?
You know, I think a lot of people are saying today, well, we can't take too much out of this. I mean, there were just incredibly specific results to this race. But if you look at this race compared to every other special election this year, you've seen a real surge in energy on the Democratic side and not as much excitement on the Republican side. By and large, the Republican base, Republican voters still support President Trump by large margins. That hasn't changed too much. But you're seeing a real enthusiasm gap, and Democrats are going out, knocking on doors, donating money to their candidates, and more importantly, getting to the polls at higher numbers than typical. And Republicans have certainly fallen off from last year. So I think that raises major questions about Democrats' ability to compete and maybe take back the House next year.
Well, today in Congress, House and Senate Republicans reached an agreement in principle on this tax bill, cutting the corporate tax rate and the top income tax rate. We have this Republican, or rather a new Democrat, who's not seated yet. Does Senator-elect Doug Jones of Alabama have any impact on this debate over the Republican tax bill?
Probably not. It looks like Jones would not arrive in the Senate until January. That would have been the case, whether it was Jones or Moore. There's a couple-week process of certifying the vote, especially if Roy Moore is going to continue to not concede the race, as is the case, I believe, as of right now. I haven't seen him say anything since last night when he said he's not conceding yet. So that's going to be a couple weeks of a process. And we're hearing that the Republican leaders have wrapped up the big picture agreement, getting the House tax bill and the Senate tax bill on the same page. So that's going to be public either tomorrow or Friday. And the goal is to vote on this Monday and Tuesday next week.
Okay, so not the big tax bill, which affects so many people. Then what do you think Doug Jones, what effect does he have? What's the likeliest large effect this Alabama vote is likely to have?
Well, I think in the political climate, the morale boost to Democrats all over the country is a huge, probably the top impact that he'll have. I mean, Democrats walked through 2017 not knowing what was up and what was down, questioning their ability to read polls, questioning their ability to do anything. I mean, so many Democrats across the country thought that Hillary Clinton was a shoo-in to win, and they just couldn't recover from the jar of President Donald Trump. And now they closed the year winning a huge election in Virginia, almost turning the state house there that had been deeply Republican. And now, even more incredibly, winning a Senate seat in Alabama. So I think the Democrats feel like, hey, we can compete. We're not on the sidelines, and we can make a run of these elections next year. So that's big. And secondly, anything that Republicans try to do next year, and it's worth noting that we don't really have a clear sense yet what the Republican agenda, what the White House agenda will be in 2018, but they're going to have zero room for error. Two senators, holding out, having demands, saying they're not going to vote for something unless it changes, will derail any Republican bill. And I can name six or seven Republican senators right now that President Trump has consistently alienated who aren't really in the mood to get on board with the White House on anything.
We've been talking with NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow. Scott, thanks.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And back to the chair of the Washington State Republican Party, Susan Hutchinson. Here in Washington State, Republicans don't have the governor or the House, and you just lost your Senate majority with East Side voters choosing Monka Dhingra. What is your case that the GOP is succeeding in Washington State?
Because I think we're going to pick up a few more seats in the House and turn the House in 2018. And the reason why, you know, and I know that people have trouble putting their arms or their brains around this, is that Donald Trump has had such an impact in our coastal districts, our legislative districts, that blue-collar Democrats have flipped. And in fact, we saw one of those seats flip in 2016, and there are more to come. So those folks who have struggled for so long, unemployed, no jobs, frustrated, they really love Donald Trump, and they believe he's going to make their lives better. And so that gives a great opportunity to flip some seats in the House, because, as you know, all the House seats, the state House seats, are up in 2018.
Then what is your take on why President Trump's approval ratings have consistently been so low, still are?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it is that inability for people to tell pollsters how they really feel if they have a sense that they'll be shamed for it. We've seen this in polling going on now for probably 3 or 4 years. The polls are generally 5% off because of that factor. So people aren't honest. And the other thing is, I think people, when they're asked that particular question, it gives them a chance to say, well, you know what, I'm not really that comfortable with his demeanor. But they love what he's accomplishing. They are so proud of the courage it took to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. They love his appointments to the Supreme Court and other court positions. They're excited about tax reform, long, long overdue. And so the things that he's doing are really what people are going to reap the benefits from. And then at every dinner table, the discussion is about his nature, his tweets, his personality, you know, and that's the part I think that's captured in that question of the 37%.
Well, you mentioned tax reform. As I said, the big news out of Congress today is House and Senate Republicans agreeing in principle on this tax bill. Republican Senator Marco Rubio warned that the GOP cannot become identified with the country club big business image, quoting Reagan there. Republican Senator Bob Corker said, quote, about this tax bill, our nation continues to rack up huge debts, and this is another step in that direction. You know that the nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation said this bill will add $1 trillion to the debt, even after you account for economic growth generated by the tax cuts. Why should people be excited about this?
Well, on the other hand, you could also be giving quotes, and there are dozens of them, from others on the Republican side who love the fact that we're finally fixing our tax situation so that the middle class will begin to enjoy more benefits. You know, it's always the case, and this is what they don't realize in the city of Seattle, the middle class is so huge in America that they really carry the burden of taxation. And so anything we can do, and this is what Donald Trump understands, anything we can do to alleviate that tax burden is really good. And if we can, through bringing down the corporate tax rate, allow our corporations in America to compete with those around the world, that'll mean jobs. And the benefit of jobs is that the more jobs you have, the scarcer the employee availability is, which forces up wages. And that's been the stagnation for so long, at least a dozen years or more. Wages have been stagnant because of the fact that we didn't have jobs. So when we talk about more jobs, we're talking about increasing wages because it's supply and basic supply and demand.
Okay. Finally, we talked about how you think that the President Trump's approval ratings are misleading. It sounds like you also think when the polls show Americans don't like this tax bill, support is in the 20-something range. You think when are people going to be won over? What's going to happen?
You and I probably watch that tax bill closer than 99% of
yes.
Americans, and then they're asked a question by a pollster and they think, well, I don't think I can say it's good because I've been told by all the media that it's bad. So wait until they start getting their tax refunds. Then they're going to have a totally different attitude.
Susan Hutchison, chair of the Washington State Republican Party, talking about issues national and local. Thanks again, Susan, for coming.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
The Record on KUOW. We'll be right back. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. We'd love your reaction to the conversations we're having today. So, Harvey Weinstein, accused of sexual misconduct, he's out of a job. Kevin Spacey, Louis C.K., Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, other media and entertainment figures have lost work. But last night, Roy Moore came close, as we discussed, came close to being elected to the U.S. Senate. And Clarence Thomas is still on the bench. Bill Clinton stayed in the White House. Donald Trump is still there. Why are media figures held to a higher standard than public officials? My guest is a former assistant U.S. attorney and Whitewater investigator, Kim Whaley. Welcome to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill.
Kim, this is how Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan put it. He told NPR that politicians face a watershed moment.
I think we're all realizing that sexual harassment in America is absolutely pervasive, and it's got to go, and we need to end it. And nowhere more is this important to set a standard and example than elected officials.
If elected officials are realizing that sexual harassment has to end, why do accused politicians leave more slowly than in the private sector?
Well, they don't have the power to give each other a pink slip. The voters do. So in Congress, the only way that someone could technically be fired is under the Constitution is for two-thirds of a particular House to actually vote to expel them for misconduct, which is close to impossible. The other option is political pressure, which we're seeing happening. But as far as just saying, listen, the bottom line's being hurt by this scandal, we need to make money for the company, you're out, that's not an option for politicians.
I want to talk more about the political process. Do you think Hollywood and the media are a model of accountability?
Well, I think it's translating these days into more accountability than the public sector, but hardly a model. I mean, at least the rumors are that some of this behavior had been going on behind the scenes for quite a while, and higher-ups tolerated it because it wasn't actually making an impact on the company. Once it became public, with the media having access to it, the information, and some of these women coming forward publicly, then the retribution and the accountability was swift. So in that regard, yeah, there's more incentive to hold these people accountable when there's a dollar bottom line at issue, whereas in the public sector, it's a lot more attenuated. And it's set up that way on purpose by the framers of the Constitution, actually.
Well, so in Hollywood and the media and business in general, it's the dollar bottom line. You could argue that's the case in financing of elections as well. What is Washington, D.C.'s feedback mechanism?
The feedback mechanism, sure. I mean, you raise the question of money in politics, and that's a complicated one, and it certainly does impact this notion of democracy that we live under. But beyond that, I mean, the impact is, as I mentioned, listen, we've got to wait to go to the polls, and I think what happened yesterday with Roy Moore is an example of pure democracy at work. That's exactly how the framers wanted it to go. The voters made clear that even in a nearly purely red state, they didn't want a person with that record of alleged wrongdoing in the Senate. And so it sort of took it out of the hands of Congress, whether they're pressure Roy Moore to resign or to expel him. The voters spoke on that, and I think in that regard, it demonstrates democracy works, although with sitting members of Congress, or the president for that matter, we have to wait for the next election unless there's some internal incentive to resign.
Well, what about expulsion and impeachment? Let's start with that. Can congressional leaders expel a member for something they did before they took office?
That's a great question. I think the Constitution is unclear on that. It refers to misconduct. And I think probably the better reading is that it really is for an abuse of office. And if they did something prior to taking office, that's not exactly abuse of power in office. So I think if it came to that expulsion for something that preceded someone's term in Congress, then there would be potentially a court battle over whether that expulsion was constitutional or not, and we've seen how that drags down lots of things in terms of our politics working and government working.
Yes, you point out in a piece that I read of yours how rare it is to be expelled from Congress and why it happens.
Sure. So, you know, historically it's happened for, you know, things on a level of treason, and it's, as I mentioned, it takes two-thirds of the particular chamber, and you know, with these numbers, you're talking people from both sides of the aisle, and as we can see, it's hard to agree on almost anything these days in Congress because it's so polarized.
What about impeachment? President Clinton stayed in office. President Trump has, so far, a Republican House and Senate. What are the odds of impeachment for personal allegations that, again, so far with President Trump, happened before he took office, if they happened?
Well, that's a different provision of the Constitution. It refers to high crimes and misdemeanors, and I think most scholars would say that doesn't include necessarily a crime. so I think a president probably could be impeached for things other than what happened in office. And we saw some of the, you know, Bill Clinton's prior history of dealing with, you know, women prior to taking office being an issue. But I think, again, it would be a highly, highly politicized process, and one that would be difficult, I think, to see through in this particular Congress with both houses in the Republican chamber. Now, we've heard some talk of potential investigations, at least some call for investigations of the allegations of sexual misconduct against President Trump. But that remains to be seen whether Congress actually takes steps to investigate that. I think it's more likely that if there's any call for impeachment, it would be around Robert Mueller's investigation of the Russian influence in the election.
When it comes to sexual misconduct allegations, what about the court system? What are there any changes, realistic changes, to our justice system that would allow prosecutors to hold accused people more accountable than they are now?
So in the private sector, there are two ways. One is, you know, criminal liability for sexual misconduct, or all the way to rape, and that varies by state. In the private sector, when it comes to civil liability, there's a statute, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that Congress decided that sexual harassment's illegal. And there's some hoops that people have to jump through, but they're really different than the hoops that women have to jump through to make claims against members of Congress. So to answer your question, you know, we've seen some calls and some movement towards making the process of bringing claims against members of Congress more transparent. I think that would be a step in the right direction. Beyond that, you know, it requires an appetite on prosecutors to actually bring these claims. And I used to defend these claims in on behalf of the Department of Justice in the civil side. And it takes a lot of guts for a woman to come forward, even in court, because, you know, her whole personal history becomes subject to impeachment. So there are a lot of barriers to entry. It's not an easy fix legally. It really is something that has moral and ethical implications that I think go beyond the Constitution and statutes.
Do you think that political bodies can change their reporting, their complaint system, their accountability system in a way that can really change the game on the culture of sexual harassment and the reporting of it?
Sure, definitely. In Congress, we have a particular situation now where it's 3 months for a complainant to even be able to bring a claim in Congress in the administrative process. And, you know, members of Congress get paid, their lawyers paid, the claimant does not, everything is confidential. If there's a settlement, it's paid out of public money. So, you know, to the extent to which members have to pay claims out of their own budget, they actually feel the impact, to the extent to which it's made public. I think all of those kinds of changes would make it more likely that people would bring claims, and more likely that members and others in Congress in particular would pay attention to these laws. I mean, it's human nature. If there are no consequences for bad behavior, people do it. I mean, if no one pings you for parking in front of a hydrant on your street, you do it all the time. If everyone gets a ticket when the car pulls up, then people don't park in front of that hydrant. And it's no different, really, when we're talking about sexual misconduct, unfortunately.
I'm talking with former Assistant U.S. Attorney Kim Whaley. Overall, you have said don't look to the Constitution to be a great protector. Why is that?
Well, the framers set it up so that the people manage their own government. And so the notion is voters have to vote these folks out of office. And I think what happened yesterday is voters woke up and said, listen, this matters to us, even though we have other issues on the table. Abortion was one, I think, that a lot of people talked about in Alabama. Even though we have other issues that matter to us, this is one that we're going to actually vote on. So it's just a very slow, attenuated process to hold people accountable at the polls. I mean, of course, you know, we can call our members of Congress to put political pressure. We saw that with Nancy Pelosi and others, and Representative Conyers resigning and Al Franken resigning. So that can happen, although, you know, there's been some pushback on that, the notion being that that's also unconstitutional because it could ultimately be the voters who decide, not members of Congress pressuring their colleagues to resign. But that's another issue.
How do you see Congress figuring out which behavior is unacceptable? Is it personal body comments, propositioning, patting, groping, offers to be a surrogate parent. It's one thing after another.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's been some concern that, okay, now are we, if someone holds a door open for a woman, is there going to be a claim of, you know, some kind of sexual misconduct? And we know in the criminal context, as I mentioned before, there are different levels of sexual assault. There's groping all the way to rape. And I think we know as a society what the lines are, you know, in our own social behavior. So I think that will hopefully sort itself out. I mean, we've seen certainly, as you mentioned, resignations for a whole range of behavior. I think what happened, the allegations against Roy Moore were probably, you know, the apex of what is the most serious in our society. And the fact that the voters drew a line there, I think, is significant. Beyond that, the way this works is case by case by case. And so transparency in Congress, to the extent to which we can get a sense of how these are being managed and handled and made public, which ones are settled and which ones are not, that's kind of how the law sorts out where to draw the lines between something that's just awkward, something that's inappropriate, and something that's unlawful.
Finally, Kim, some Democrats say Democrats shouldn't purge misbehaving members if Republicans don't do it. Where do you stand on that?
I think that's a political question. My view, and I'm writing a book on this and I've been speaking on this, is that the constitutional values that we all hold dear are not expressed in the Constitution. You can't just walk into court and enforce it. So I think it's a good thing if our elected leaders take stands on sort of, you know, the softer values in the Constitution, including transparency, accountability, honesty, integrity, all of those things. So I wouldn't be too hard on the Democrats. I mean, in best case scenario, we kind of see across the board more of this type of self-correcting process if it's too difficult to wait for the next election to actually make that kind of a difference.
Kim Whaley is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore and a former assistant United States attorney. Kim, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
We've been talking about why Washington can be slower than Hollywood to hold men accountable. And she says politicians don't have bosses or an HR department. They've got us. And in places like Alabama, voters are beginning to clean house. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. Back in a moment. 1 year ago on this show, we talked with two friends, women who grew up here. They were both worried about how the country would change, particularly for women and people of color, after Donald Trump took office. And they hoped Seattle might actually become an inclusive place for people of color. One of them was planning to leave the country.
I want to watch this from afar. I don't want my money to stimulate this economy. And I hate to say that, but it's true.
The other was digging deeper roots in Seattle.
I'm not going anywhere. I want to build and to have a foundation here.
1 year later, Jen Peterson and Audra Boo are back with us to talk about what's changed for them and what hasn't, and whether Seattle is living up to its progressive ideals. Audra and Jen, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Audra, you never left. You stayed here in Seattle. And Jen, you moved to Belize. You said that was the right decision. Why are you so sure of that?
So I had a friend in Belize, and she said, you know, come down and try it and see how you feel. And I went down there and immediately fell in love with the land and the people and the heat and myself. And
fell in love with yourself.
Yeah, yeah, found me again.
Oh.
Yeah. The noise stopped.
The noise stopped. Yeah. Audra, is any of that making you rethink your decision? Or were you able
no.
to fall in love with yourself in Seattle?
I've been feeling ben myself here for a long time. I mean, wherever I am, I can feel myself. So, you know, for all the reasons that Jen decided to leave, you know, it's a combination of reasons, not just what was going on here politically, but a number of reasons. And all those things combined made it, yeah, a good idea for Jen to leave. And to hear her talk about the fact that she is now in love with herself, that she got a chance to find herself, that's the best part. I, on the other hand, I'm still here. I'm still Black. I'm still queer. Mm-hmm. I'm still chilling and still have no need or want to leave for any reason, really.
Jen, how do you see Seattle differently after a year away?
I do see a lot of the Black community mobilizing in ways that I haven't seen before, which I'm very proud of.
How do you see that?
I just see a lot of groups that are popping up that are looking to shed light on the Black community in Seattle, which I, again, I'm very, very proud of. Do I think it's changed much? No.
How much did dark skin figure into your wanting to be in Belize instead of Seattle?
Oh, a lot. And especially when I got there, because I realized that it's dark and it's lovely and the people there are different. One of the first things I realized is that Black people are different there. They are free and they know it. They don't get up. I mean, everybody worries about something everywhere in the world, but these guys don't get up and worry about getting shot. They don't worry about walking down the street and being called the hard R. You know, they jump in the water and swim. You know what I mean? That's unheard of. You know, out in America, most Black people, I don't swim. We don't, scared of dogs, all this other stuff, you know? They're just free. That's one of the first things I realized, and I like it. It's kind of my jam.
Still glad you stayed?
Yeah.
Andra?
Yeah. I can visit Belize. That's not an issue.
How can you be free in Seattle?
You know, I don't want to say free is subjective, but at least I feel like for my own self, I feel like maybe my situation is different from most people because I have my hand in home ownership and I am doing what the types of things that my grandma would have been super proud of, like go to work, be responsible, you know, do good yourself, like you yourself do good things and save your money and have a house and have a family and bring that family up and do it wherever you want to do it. And right here is where I want to do it.
Why?
You know, why? Maybe because I like it here. As much as it's not the most progressive, it doesn't mean I don't like it. I mean, Seattle has not been bad to me. I mean, there's been moments. I've had moments. You know, I'll never forget one time being confused for a woman who stole from a store and being put in the back of a police car right before I had to go to work. And I was the opener. And I got pulled over, or not even pulled over. I was walking. They just rolled up on me and put me in the back of a car and took me back to the store and had the person come out. And the person said, that's not her. But I was just Black and walking. And you don't forget those types of things. But I have a community of people who I can be myself with, who I can vent to, who I can perform with and alongside. You know, it's...
That love you.
Yeah. And it's like, I just don't feel hard-pressed to leave.
Jen, you left Seattle, went to Belize, you've come back. You don't live here. You still live in Belize.
Yes.
But you visit... you said that I think you told me that you felt like Audra was, I don't know, like a better person than you for staying and.
Well, yeah, I feel like most definitely, Audra. I feel like you. I realize that leaving isn't necessarily cowardly, but it's not necessarily staying to fight. You know what I mean? I don't want to call it a fight because we've been doing this forever. But yeah, I am proud of people like you who don't decide to jump ship. I am very happy. And like you said, I left for many reasons, not just this presidency, not just Seattle, you know? I left for personal reasons as well. But I think that people who stay and can face this without wanting to choke somebody, I'm proud of you guys, you know?
No, I didn't say I didn't want to choke nobody.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you already know I was... My mom told me to get out before I go to jail. When I came back through customs, my dad said, muzzle yourself, Jennifer. You know, and I had to muzzle myself coming back through customs.
What happened at customs?
When I got, you know, you come through Miami coming from Belize, and they let you know you're going to be walking through customs. So you have your bags, and you're kind of walking through. And it wasn't one of the countries that 45 had on his travel ban. So you just sort of walk through this hallway. And it's a big, long hallway. And people are walking, and there's random customs officers sort of milling about, sort of swimming upstream, coming towards you. And I look around, and all the white people are walking past, like nothing's happening. And a customs officer comes up to me and grabs my passport, doesn't say a thing to me. I'm like, excuse me, do you want to talk to me? I'm going to say something to me like, what are you grabbing this for? He's like, well, where are you coming from? You know, being all sort of nice and chatty, which means for me a chat is just kind of douchey, if I can say that on air. And he, you know, he asked me where I was going and he started walking and I'm walking with him and I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, well, we want to know a little bit about you and when did you get your ticket and what are you back here for? And I was like, I was, you know, being smart and remembering my dad and muzzling myself. And I said I was on vacation for a while and, you know, I'm back for a while and I might go back, blah, blah, blah. And he brings me back to this sort of area where there's tables everywhere and behind this sort of like screen. And I look down this long aisle of tables and it's just brown and black people. Absolutely, there's not, I am not lying to you, there is not one person that is not of color that is being checked their baggage, right? So fine, I open my stuff, or he opens the stuff up and my baggage is packed very neatly. And he immediately says to me, he said something about my packing. I said, oh, you're not going to compliment me on my pack job. And he was like, well, people like you scare me. He's like, I'd rather things be messy. And I was like, okay. And again, remembering my dad, Jennifer, muzzle yourself. So just trying to get, and I'm, again, I, when I get frustrated, I start to tear up. You already know this. So I'm starting to like get teary-eyed and I'm like literally minutes into the country and it's happening again, right? And there's a picture of my sisters and me on the top of my luggage, like on top of my clothing. And it's me and my two white sisters. And it's very obvious who's who. And he looks at me and he says, oh, sisters, which one are you? And this other brown customs officer was like, dude. And I was like, the black one? Can I go now? And at that same time, I'm just, you know, again, remembering, muzzle yourself, but I'm starting to get upset. I'm actually starting to get upset right now. And it just, so a reminder, you know, and an immediate reminder, like literally seconds within crossing that border that, yeah, you're here. It was a week after Charlottesville. Welcome home.
Jen, it sounds like, I was going to ask you, did you make the right decision by leaving Seattle? It sounds
yes, sir.
Like you did.
Yes, sir. My heart is still here. Again, it's still my city. But yeah, I'm at where I'm at for a reason. And I like watching it from afar. I still get upset, but I don't yell as much. And I don't spend every day mired down in like what it all means and where I fit in. And even being back for as long as I have this time, I was different when I first came back, very calm. And I feel myself sort of turning that corner. So leaving on Monday is very exciting for me. I get to sort of, I can see calm in my future. You know, again, like I said, I'm very proud of people who can stay and find themselves a space where they're calm. And I've learned a lot about myself in that running doesn't always solve everything. I've learned that. But I do know that I'm happy where I'm at. I know I made the right decision.
Audra, are you a better person than Jen for staying?
You know, it's funny because I was thinking that I don't want to say that I'm better than Jen. Like, that's ridiculous. This is
family.
And I don't want to say that I'm better than anyone for staying. Like, I don't think that's necessarily the comment to be made. I think, you know, when you are just strong in your will, you will do what you have to do. It's like that pin that, you know, nevertheless, she persisted. Because I'm not going nowhere. And I don't even like to quote Hillary or none of that or nothing related.
Yeah, why did you eat? You almost ate Hillary when you said that.
I mean, I'm just saying, nevertheless, you know, she persisted. I am still moving forward. I am still doing what I need to do. I'm still learning new things all the time. I just choose to, you know, cut out what I don't need. Now, if only I can do that with my regular nutrition, I'd be real good to go. But it's not an easy task either to be this. I'm staying. Well, like I said, I'm still black. I haven't left, and it doesn't make me want to leave. It just makes me go, mm-hmm, mm, mm-hmm. It's my permanent, you know, phrasing on all things. Whenever I see things happening, and it's like, the you know, black, when you guys start mentioning black and start putting around black and people of color, I go, mm, 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 mm. That is, it's been a lot of that. You can ask everybody black that. We all, mm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So hence the reason why I say that you are better than me. You know how I mean that. You know me. So I'm saying that because you're here. And I know what it means to be here.
Audra Boo is a singer and actor here in Seattle. Jen Peterson worked at KEXP in the Cloud Room on Capitol Hill. Now she's an expat. Audra's performing at a show called The Hanukkah Party on Saturday, December 16th at Fred Wildlife Refuge on Capitol Hill. This is The Record on KUOW. 94.9 Seattle. That's it for today. Our show is put together by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bond Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening today.